traditional warrior connection. Respect is what you get from the Progressive Radio Network, the incredible work of Dr. Gary Knoll and all of us here on Warrior Connection. Unfortunately, day after day, we keep finding out more and more stuff is not told to the veteran, more and more stuff is not put in their medical records, and it never ends, and we're trying to get all the answers. Well, towards getting the answers, what we're going to talk about is some of the research, medical research, actual treatment protocol stuff that we're looking at, what can make the life better for each veteran. And to explain all that to it, we've got Dr. Sullivan. Dr. Sullivan, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you very much, Doug. A pleasure to be here today. For your listeners, my name is Dr. Kimberly Sullivan. I am at Boston University School of Public Health. I'm an assistant professor here. And I'm also the former associate scientific director for the Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses. And currently I run a research study called the Boston Gulf War Illness Consortium Study. And our consortium brings researchers from all parts of the country together to understand the cause of Gulf War illness and to develop treatments for it.
Okay. Dr. Sullivan, can you give us a little background of how you got involved with Gulf War illness? Kind of a brief summary. You go back many years with us.
I do go back many years. I started out shortly after the time of the Gulf War. I was training as a neuropsychologist at the Boston VA, and we were seeing many Gulf War veterans coming through our clinic for evaluations of memory problems, memory and concentration problems. And these were people who were, you know, as you recall at that time, in their 20s and early 30s, and really shouldn't have been having memory and concentration problems. And that was sort of the peak of my interest in trying to understand what was happening with our Gulf War veterans. And then we were very fortunate that the Boston area researchers were invited to do some early research on Gulf War illness. My mentor, Roberta White, was doing some research on toxicant exposures at that time. And so she was asked to look into some of the exposures that Gulf War veterans had. And so over a series of years, we were able to do different studies looking at some of the unique exposures that Gulf War veterans had, things like pesticide exposures that were heavily used in the Gulf War, the pyridostigmine bromide anti-nerve gas pills, as well as the sarin exposures. And so over a series of studies, we came to understand that, of course, these are similarly acting types of exposures that seem to be causing Gulf War illness. And the Research Advisory Committee that I was formerly involved with came to the conclusion after reviewing several different research studies, including our own as well as others, that it looked like that was what was pushing some of Gulf War illness. And it seemed clear that over the years during the studies that it was most certainly not post-traumatic stress disorder or other stress-related illnesses, because as we know, post-traumatic stress disorder happens in about less than 10% of Gulf War veterans, and about 30% of Gulf War veterans have Gulf War illness. So although they can happen in both, you know, both veterans can have PTSD and Gulf War illness, they are not one and the same.
Well, we started seeing that right away because at the time when we started seeing all the complex exposures, we had all the complex hazard materials exposures. We had the chem biological exposures, the nuke exposures from both depleted uranium, and then we had all the radiological materials. And we had all the endemic diseases. And I mean, right off the bat, when we got over there in the fall of 1990, everybody was getting sick, and we were extraordinarily healthy. And I think, Denise, you started seeing all these aberrant behaviors and memory and cognitive behaviors and you know, movement functions right there in Iraq, didn't you?
I sure did. But let's move on quickly because I know Dr. Sullivan can't spend all the time with us today. So, Kimberly, tell us about the new studies that y'all are running, the consortium. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So as I was talking a little bit about some of the exposures and the different studies we've done with Gulf War veterans over the years, we identified that that was something that seemed to be associated with Gulf War illness, but we didn't understand what the cause of that might be. And so we now know that the brain and the immune system are activated as part of the inflammatory response to these pesticide and nerve agent exposures. And these chemicals from the Gulf War directly target the nervous system. They can cause inflammation by release of chemical messengers in the brain and throughout the body. And in the brain, we call this neuroinflammation. And this chronic low-level inflammation can cause all of the symptoms of Gulf War illness, including fatigue, joint and muscle pain, concentration and memory problems. And our Gulf War Illness Consortium study in Boston is designed to test whether this chronic inflammation is at the root of Gulf War illness.
Okay.
And so our consortium studies are designed to identify diagnostic markers of Gulf War illness and to develop treatments for Gulf War illness. And our main clinical study is currently recruiting 300 Gulf War veterans, and that's including healthy and sick veterans at three sites around the country, including Boston, Miami, and Houston. And so we want to make sure that we're getting veterans who have symptoms, and we also would like to compare healthy veterans so that we can do a comparison of both in our studies. And our main study includes one visit. That includes blood draws for these inflammatory markers, brain imaging studies, cognitive testing, and also saliva samples to look for genetic vulnerabilities of why some veterans are more susceptible to develop this chronic neuroinflammation than others are.
Your the sputum you collect, where is that going to?
That's a good question. So that is actually going to Australia. We have 9 study sites around the country that are participating in our studies that are in the U.S., and then we actually have a site in Australia because some of the leading experts in immune genetics are there. So that's University of Adelaide is where those are going.
Okay, and that's a new development. So I want to ask, you know, you've explained the purpose generally and the universities involved. I don't think you listed all the universities of the 9, but there's quite a few.
There are quite a few.
How does, let's stop it there. Notice that you have University of Colorado Boulder there. What are they doing to contribute?
Sure. So they are actually doing some of the animal work. So I was talking primarily about the work we're doing with veterans, but we also have lab researchers. So we have animal and cell researchers that are working with us. And the Boulder group is actually looking at our animal models of pain and cognitive problems from these exposures. And that's how we've understood how some of these inflammation works in relation to exposures, is some of our lab researchers who showed us this. And now we will try some treatments in that model, and then we'll bring in those, the most promising of the treatments from the lab studies, to our Gulf War veterans. And in that way, we're trying to be efficient in terms of cost for studies, as well as picking the most promising studies to bring to our veterans.
That makes sense. So we have treatment trials that are starting more and more, besides just what we've had in the past of yoga, acupuncture. We're really getting into more details of potential treatment. So that's a positive hope. Let's go back to the biological implication here of what are we actually looking at so far that has gone wrong in our body?
That's a good question. So as I was mentioning, what we think is happening is that we think we have caused chronic inflammation from the brain, directly from these toxicant exposures that Gulf War veterans have had. And this is, of course, a chronic illness, so this has been happening over 25 years at this point. And it's this chronic signaling of these chemical messengers we believe is at the root of what's happening in Gulf War illness. In the past, in some of our prior studies, we saw things on brain imaging. There were changes on white matter of the brain, in sarin-exposed groups, in pesticide-exposed groups, and in Gulf War illness veterans in general who had Gulf War illness and had more symptoms compared to those who had less or no symptoms. So we're seeing differences on the white matter of the brain. We're seeing some other volume changes on the brain. And we are starting to see in the small amount of participants who've been in our consortium study so far, we're seeing blood markers of these chemical messengers called cytokines that we're seeing differences in our Gulf War veterans who have Gulf War illness. So we have blood markers, we have neuroimaging markers, and we hope to have genetic markers, as I was mentioning, soon as well.
Right.
And the main point would be to get to a diagnostic test so that, of course, you know that Gulf War veterans right now, it's a symptom-based disorder. So we say if you have Gulf War illness, not based on the symptoms you're reporting. We would like to be able to get to a blood test or some other kind of diagnostic marker that doesn't have to rely so much on these self-report measures.
Yeah, because the research you're doing with cytokines is research-based. I mean, it's
correct.
Not a test that the veterans can commonly get anywhere except through research, correct?
That's correct at this point. So what we'll need to determine with these studies is which of these chemical messengers are the most important for Gulf War illness. And then once we can validate it in a large enough sample, that's why we're trying to see 300 veterans, then we could try and devise a diagnostic test for Gulf War illness that's approved at VAs and at other hospitals.
Okay. That would be a tremendous step forward, because we have a hang-up with compensation, and it seems to me that the, you know, compensation is best based on chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia. There's some potential tests coming out or are out for civilians, but we're not exactly comparable to the civilians. We have different exposures. So how do you see that developing? Would any of these tests have come out for civilians, testing for chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, be appropriate for Gulf War veterans?
That's a good question, Denise. I think at this point, we're trying to develop our own for Gulf War illness, just for the reason that you just mentioned, the exposure. So we think of course, this is an exposure-driven illness, and so we're trying to see if we can devise the most sensitive for Gulf War illness. Now, will that also translate to some of the other illnesses that Gulf War veterans have, chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia? Perhaps it will as well, but I think we're trying to develop specifically for the for Gulf War veterans with particular exposures. I will say also, something else we're developing as a separate study is to see if we can find markers of prior changes in the brain in the blood samples from our Gulf War veterans. So these are antibodies to brain proteins that really should not be in the blood of our Gulf War veterans. And if they are there, it indicates that there was some damage at some point. And we actually have a study that's recently funded to look at that. And we hope that that may, in fact, be a marker for Gulf War illness as well, or types of exposures Gulf War veterans have had.
When we look at the concept of genetic susceptibility, which could have tremendous implications for assigning individuals specific duties or preventing exposures, is there anything on that or anything new or any ideas or thoughts on that?
So what we're doing with our genetic testing is we are looking to see folks who have particular genetic vulnerability to releasing these chemical messengers more than others when the system is activated. So we are looking for people who have particular genetic vulnerability to activating cytokines. And so that's what we're looking at in our consortium study in terms of looking at the genetic piece. Other studies are looking at things like PON1, which actually is the enzyme that processes the organophosphate exposures that Gulf War veterans have had, so sarin or the pesticides. So you can also be more vulnerable if you have, the PON1 genotype that makes you less able to process those types of exposures. So there is research going on to do that as well, and actually we're collaborating with three sites around the country to do that as well.
When we looked at the oil well fires, they're very complex, heavy metal, inorganic, organic compounds, everything under the sun, when we look at that mixture of the analysis, and those seem to have such complex physiological effects and synergistic, in other words, what we are seeing right off, and what I've got a feeling for personally my own, is 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2. 1 + 1 equals a horrible 5.
Yeah, I think you've hit it right on. That's, I think, exactly right. And we've looked at that in some prior studies we did with pesticide applicators from the Gulf War. And we looked at that, and we said, okay, if you had a couple of different exposures, you know, is it just additive or is it more synergistic, like you're saying, you know, 2 + 2 = 6 or something? And it seems to be that that actually probably is the case. So it's these cumulative exposures that we think is with similarly acting types of chemicals that we think is actually at the root of Gulf War illness. And this has been shown in animal models. So there's a study with wild salmon fish actually showing this with the same types of pesticides that Gulf War veterans are exposed to, as well as to animal studies, so mice and rats as well, showing just that point that these exposures cause synergistic effects as opposed to additive effects. And we think they are actually cause these cumulative effects on inflammation in the brain. So that's why we're most particularly interested in looking at this inflammation piece.
this inflammatory process, I mean, for me, it's ongoing right now because our weather just has changed again horribly in the last few hours. But what can we do? Is there any thoughts on treatment to alleviate this now, or what we can do to make our lives better for all the vets out there that are suffering?
Yes. So we actually are trying to, we're trying to really get the causation and the mechanism of Gulf War illness with our consortium study. But we're also, we have several treatment trials that are aimed towards reducing this inflammation in the brain in our veterans as well. So we actually have a treatment trial of intranasal insulin. This is actually a nasal pump that actually does reduce the inflammation. It also stimulates the memory areas of the brain to help with cognitive improvement. That's being run at Boston and Bronx, New York, two sites there. We also have another treatment trial of something called D-cycloserine. That's a pill that actually improves cognitive functioning and also reduces neuroinflammation as well. That's going to be starting in the next couple of months in the Boston area. And there's going to be a coenzyme Q10 treatment trial, which will be a multi-site treatment trial that will be at four sites across the country, including Nova, Southeastern in Florida, Minnesota VA, the Bronx VA, and the Boston VA will run those. And this is the first phase 3 treatment trial of Gulf War illness that we hope will reduce fatigue and improve cognitive functioning in our Gulf War veterans. And a phase 3 treatment trial is the last phase before it becomes approved for use in the clinic if successful. So if this trial is successful, we hope that coenzyme Q10 will be the first treatment trial that will be approved for use across the country for Gulf War illness.
Well, as a teacher, former professor and everything, I've taught everything from kindergarten through graduate school, a lot of the military, the cognitive ability and the neuromuscular losses they have interfere with learning and interfere with job performance. And these young kids, they got to have a hope and a dream to go forward. But when they have these horrible cognitive function problems that we're seeing, it's very hard for them to learn and to get educated either vocationally or academically and then move on with their life.
That's exactly right, and that's something we kept seeing over and over in the clinic years ago when our Gulf War veterans were young and coming back and trying to go back to work and then, you know, take night classes, and they were having tremendous difficulty doing that. And so I think you're absolutely right there. And unfortunately, it's these type of toxic wounds that, you know, don't result in loss of limbs or things like that, but can really affect, you know, our veterans just as much as any other type of injury, you know, these brain injuries that are not necessarily apparent when people look at our veterans, but they're still struggling and suffering just as much as anybody else.
And we lost one of our co-hosts and our best friend, Paul Lyons, a little over a year ago when he reached the breaking point, committed suicide. He couldn't function. He couldn't get medical care. His wife and his children were sick. And I mean, you know, we had this cross-contamination that we're seeing all over from the spouse. One spouse brought it back, or a family member brought it back, and next thing we know, we got family members who were never deployed or never involved sick.
Yeah, very sorry to hear that. And, you know, this is something that we don't understand very well at this point.
Yeah, we're still at the level of trying to understand the veteran, much less how this may relate to families.
That's right.
And one thing that I'm finding is a correlation possibly not only with overseas, you know, duty during the war, but, you know, if they were stationed at any of the facilities that are chemically contaminated, you know, like Fort McClellan, Camp Lejeune, and we're finding more and more bases that were exposed. So, you know, I try to tell the families that this may not be from, you know, exposure from the Gulf War. It may be, you know, if the family was with them on a contaminated base. So it's a very complicated picture when you look at overall military veteran health issues. Now, I understand y'all are doing spinal taps, so would you talk about that portion of it?
Sure. So I talked a little bit about the main study that we're doing, but we actually have several callback studies, and one of the callback studies is a lumbar puncture study. So that is where we get a small amount of cerebrospinal fluid. And the importance of that fluid, of course, is it comes directly from the brain, so it tells us what are the cytokines or what types of chemical messengers are directly in the brain fluid that then we can compare with the blood And in that way, we can try and develop a diagnostic test for Gulf War illness based on the blood that correlates with that cerebrospinal fluid. So that's one of the callback studies we're doing. We also have some advanced neuroimaging callback studies. So these are PET imaging studies where we can look at tracers of inflammation in the brain. So these are radio tracers, as you would do with other types of PET studies. And we also have a stem cell study where we're taking blood from our Gulf War veterans and turning them into stem cells where we can then expose to the different toxicants that our veterans had and see how that affects the neurons and then try different treatments there in the lab. And that's the beauty of having our consortium, that we have lab scientists as well as clinical scientists working together to develop these models. But that those are the callback studies we also have that we're looking for participants to come and do with us.
How does a veteran get involved in this? Who do they call? What do they need to do?
So they should call our coordinator, Joanna Cirillo. And Joanna, do we have our telephone number that they should call?
Yep. So my phone number is 617-638-5834. So you can give me a call and I can go through the details. Or you could give us an email if you prefer to do that. And our email address is gwic@bu.edu.
And they also have a Facebook page.
We do.
Yeah, if you search on Facebook, Gulf War Illness Consortium, it should come up.
So they are communicating in many, many ways. They had a reunion just recently. But before we go to that, I wanted to, put the veterans at ease on the callback studies. On the spinal tap, it's developed a lot better than it used to be. Are you using guided imagery to do the spinal tap and a smaller needle?
That's a good question. We actually have a very experienced neurologist who is doing the lumbar punctures for us, which we're very grateful for because, yes, people can be a little leery of that type of procedure, but we have a very, very experienced neurologist who's doing that with us and has lots of success with that procedure without any actual complications or things. So I don't think it will be as daunting as folks might think.
I know that's one of the questions I handle when I talk to veterans on when I get into the research studies, and I know Georgetown did it with imagery to guide it in, and
yeah.
It was painless. I mean, it was entirely painless, which was amazing on that. But they always ask those questions to fellow veterans that have gone through it, and, those of us that served as nurses get all these questions. Now, are there anything that we can say would be a rule out for them participating? I know that Joanne goes through that when she talks to them and, does the questionnaire. But are there any key ones that you could mention that we may need to get that info out?
So any chronic other types of disorders that may actually be causing the symptoms that the Gulf War veterans are having would be something that we would have to exclude for just so that we can make sure that we're measuring Gulf War illness and not necessarily the other disorders. So this would be chronic disorders, neurological disorders, things like Alzheimer's disease, seizure disorders, significant stroke history, things of that sort would be excluded. Any other kind of chronic illness, so chronic liver disease, hepatitis, things like that would be excluded because that could actually cause some of this inflammation we're talking about. Those are primarily the biggest exclusions. But again, of course, if any participant calls us, any veteran wants to participate in our study, we would do a screening and ask all of the different questions to make sure that they meet criteria for the study.
So you primarily have to work with individuals that live within driving distance of each of your sites, then? There's no transportation availability or support costs or anything, correct?
Unfortunately, we don't have that at the moment. We could look into that if it, becomes an issue. But right now we're looking for folks who are close by or who are willing to travel to us. We do have reimbursement for our studies, but not necessarily travel per se. We provide meals on site, and we can provide parking costs and, of course, reimbursement for each of the different studies that that a veteran would like to participate in that can offset travel costs sometimes if we can coordinate a couple of different studies that we're doing.
And the other thing that I've added in, Doug, is that we've found some veteran organizations that will help, and I want to get the word out to the veterans. Don't let the travel be, you know, a definite no for you. There's aircompassionforveterans.org online that will try to help. If they go to their DAV, VFW, the Legion, Marine Corps League, any of their local post or chapters, and present to them about the research that they're trying to get to, and if you've been, you know, already through the pre-questionnaire type thing over the phone with Joanne, and that if you're accepted into the program, that is when we can work with them to see if we can get other organizations to help get them there. But this is entirely getting with these different organizations. And the vets have to take a little responsibility here to prepare a little written letter, a little bit about the research that they can print offline, and provide that when they go to ask for assistance. But a lot of the VFWs, the Legion, their auxiliaries will try to help if they're approached at their local chapters or posts, and if they have the funds available, they will usually try to cooperate and help. It may be something that they can help up to a certain amount, but then you could go to the other organization and tell them what more you need. The vet would have to, you know, kind of pre-plan and know how much the airfare might be to give them a quote from an airline of what that cost would be. So you go in with a letter with the information that can be provided easily by the vet, and, you know, ask their local chapters and posts to help. Get online to the Air Compassion for Veterans and see if they can assist. That's a group of veterans that have connections with the airlines to try to help on getting treatment and care for veterans. So that's not a complete no. It's just that currently the CDMRP has not required their researchers to put that in their budget, although on one of my recent trips to D.C., I did find out that they're going to ask all the researchers to include that in their budgets when they ask for
from a researcher's perspective, that's actually good to hear, because that's something that wasn't necessarily something that would be approved in the past, so that's actually very interesting to hear that point, so that's great.
I found that out by talking to our, I can't remember her name, but she was there at the second IOM that we had that is looking over all CDMRP programs and funding, and talked to her directly, and she directly told me they are going to require that in the upcoming proposal.
That's great. And I would just remind your listeners that we do have sites in Boston, Miami, and Houston, and we have heard from some folks who are traveling for visiting family or for vacations or things, and some of them were willing to take a day or a half a day and come and do our study. So we are grateful to folks who are actually trying to coordinate their time to actually come and participate with us. So we're thankful very much for that. But so those are the three sites if your listeners find that they will be in those areas, you know, anytime in the coming year and a half or so. We'd be very happy to talk with you about coordinating schedules.
And as one that has participated, I know that I flew up there early in the morning out of D.C., got there, y'all got me all done, and in fact, you took me back to the airport to help me get back on my way. So you're very helpful in that manner, and I think I got there early in the morning and didn't expect to get started until, 9 o'clock, and we got started earlier and got done in plenty of time. And I've heard back from many of the vets that have steered in your direction, and they're telling others that it's beneficial, it's helpful, it can be done.
You know, Denise, that reminds me, I mean, you gave me this little button a long time ago, you know, pin on your thing, Desert Storm Guinea Pig. I mean, you've been doing this for how long now?
Oh, gosh. You know, like I said, I noticed things in theater, and we could cover this in a different program, but I noticed strange things happening in theater. And as a nurse, I was attuned to it all. And plus, I was experiencing some of the things in theater that we blew off, be it the urinary urgency, to the fact that you couldn't make it to those little box latrines, to diarrhea, to skin rashes and skin manifestations, to irritability. It was not PTSD, you know. And so I was observing all this, and when I got home, husband's mistake of getting a computer and getting me online was getting online and being able to, as, you know, having been a nurse, of interviewing people and going head-to-toe with an interview of what their health was like before, what they were, you know, having problems with, such things as visual disturbances, you know, when they're driving. And on a multi-lane highway, you might not notice it, but if you were on a two-lane highway at night, you noticed it. The disorientation, the people getting lost, that knew where they were traveling to and getting disoriented. So it was collecting a lot of info by phone, by email, and knowing that we had a problem. And one of the things that I brought up early on was they trained us for the, you know, killing dose, the dose of whatever we were exposed to that would lead us to go down in seizure activity. But they never trained on a low level and consistent low level, much less a synergistic effect of all the potential exposures. So I put my head in the books and looked at each area and researched and dug into research and knew we had problems. And that's what started my movement to get help, because I knew where I was at, we weren't getting help. And by talking to hundreds and thousands of other vets, that the other VA hospitals weren't doing much better and that we needed the experts out there. And so it's been a long road. And I knew of the pesticide research that was going on at, what was it, Fort Devens, Kimberly?
Yes, that's okay. Right.
And so keeping up with the research was helping me to have hope that we could find something to help us. In the meantime, we had to fight to try to get compensation because people are going down. They can't function. So there's been very many battles of the war after we came home. And I have just been so pleased with the researchers that have stepped out all along the way to help us, and they've stood up against a lot of criticism that we've had. And the vets are so discouraged, and this is why I wanted to have our researchers and people in line with us, is they get so discouraged and don't get the help, don't get the attention paid at their local VA because those doctors have not kept up with the research or been trained or been required to do that. And they get to the point of giving up. And we've had too many that we've lost all along the way to suicides, to cardiac problems early in life. And it was a moral, ethical duty for me, Doug, to try to keep in the fight and keep others in the fight and keep hope alive that it may take us a while, but we have so much more now than we had with Vietnam and Agent Orange. Cutting-edge research that can help us find things to improve the quality of our life.
Dr. Sullivan, are you having a free hand, or are you experiencing any interference? I mean, we all know the horror stories, and we know what was involved, and Jim and I have talked about it, and you guys have talked about it, but is there more hope for a free hand to allow all this research and the information to get out?
We certainly hope so. You know, I think one of the really important things that's happened since I've been involved in this research, and I've been involved quite some time, is the DOD Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. And I think it's really made a difference in terms of, first of all, funding more studies and funding treatments for Gulf War veterans. And, you know, as anybody who's been involved in this field knows, that there was a long period when there were really no treatments at all. And so I think the hope for our veterans is that, you know, those who have stuck with us, and we're thankful for those who have done our studies over and over you know, as we tried to figure out what was happening, have been able to stick with us and now are able, I hope, to be able to partake in some of these treatments that we hope we will be able to bring to the clinic in the short term.
Got to do something to improve the quality of life. Ray, are you there by chance? Okay. Ray, we're going to talk next week. Ray had just found another one where another widow of another guy that committed suicide that reached the have no hope, you know, like Paul did, and got to prevent that in the future. I mean, all this research you're doing, the medical treatment protocols, getting the markers, biomarkers is so critical. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, from day one, what had happened, and I go back into day one at the command headquarters, and they said we got to deny, delay, and avoid and alter our reports in order to avoid all responsibility and liability for health and environmental effects of the military operations. To say that moral injury that I got when the general handed me that Los Alamos memo was staggering.
Yeah, we're really trying to do on the research side of things everything we can for our sick veterans who have been sick for a long time. You know, so we certainly understand that. And as I said, we're grateful for all the veterans who have been willing to participate with us over the years as we understood slowly. You know, this unfortunately was a field that the researchers needed to learn as we went along. You know, we needed to learn that, you know, the dogma at the time was if you didn't have an acute poisoning from these exposures, you didn't have any chronic health effects. We had to learn that wasn't true. You know, we had to learn, okay, well, if that isn't true, what is actually causing this chronic health problem? So we slowly over time are starting to understand these things, and we're very thankful to the veterans who have stuck with us so that we can really start to get these biomarkers of exactly what's happening. We hope diagnostic tests, and we hope really targeted treatments.
I think what you just mentioned is what we found in all our work from day one is when we put together the medical managed biological casualties course that we taught, is the acute chronic versus low-level exposures levels. I mean, everybody had gone from NIOSH and OSHA saying, you've got to have this amount to get really zapped before having the effects. And
that's right.
Now we've learned it's a little dab will do you, and that little dab upon little dab about a little dab turns out to be a massive dose.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the big dose does one thing, and the lower dose actually does something else. They both can cause chronic effects, but in different ways. And so we had to take the time to learn that and do the studies. And so I think that's important not only for our Gulf War veterans, which, of course, is what we're doing this work for, but also for other exposed groups. So these are, you know, pesticide applicators around the world, other people who are exposed to these same kind of things. Unfortunately, terrorist attacks, so the Tokyo subway victims. So people in all different areas really are affected by this research as well. And so we hope that these targeted treatments will help in, you know, a host of different areas.
Yeah, I got involved in the investigation for the sarin in the Tokyo subway, and they basically what they did is they put the sarin liquid, which is like water, in baggies, and they stomped on it.
Well,
if they had any dispersal device, it would have been catastrophic in all natures.
Wow. Yeah. So, unfortunately, we're in a world where we have to be concerned about these exposures, because sometimes people say to me, well, this happened 25 years ago to these veterans, and why is it relevant to the rest of the world? Well, it's extremely relevant, unfortunately, because of the Tokyo attacks, also more recently in Syria. This is things that we really do need to understand going forward.
Dr. Anders Kornegi-Bothar, one of our members of Bowers Raiders, one of the super doctors, and we were at the CDC. This is back in 1999. We got appointed. I don't know if you were there, but I remember he stand up and said, Gulf War illness and everything, we're seeing in a very healthy population, have acute and subacute exposure, become very sick. And this is all directly related what we've seen now with the bitter living through chemistry, where we're looking at the Alzheimer's effects on the general population. And when he said that, you could have had a pin drop in that conference room.
Yeah. Yep. It's not surprising at that time.
Yep. Now, Dr. Sullivan, you had a reunion just recently on the 9th of April. How was that received? I've talked to Anthony Hardy and know what he went through, which was, I want to mention what he did and what he told me over the phone was he had all the veterans stand up that had been in the Gulf War. And then he asked those that had had symptoms remain standing and the others to sit down. He said hardly anybody sat down. And then I think he asked if they had had their compensation claims go through. And again, not many sat down, and the VA people were there with you. So I've heard about that, and how else would you describe your reunion and your research review with the veterans that came? I think there was about 100. Is that correct?
Yeah, we ended up having quite a good turnout, and I think it was good for Anthony Hardy to do that and come and talk about VA benefits or benefits available to Gulf War veterans in general. And I think it was good for the folks who were VA employees to also see people still standing. And I think it was nice for them to acknowledge that, you know, some work has been done on this front, but more needs to be done. And so I think that was a big turning point for our local veterans anyway in the Boston area to see that and to hear about the history of the research that has been done in the Boston area in particular, because we actually were in a position to see Gulf War veterans shortly after they came back through the Fort Devens cohort, which was a study that was set up to study stress results initially and quickly transitioned into looking at exposures when we realized that there was this illness that was happening with our veterans. So it was sort of fortuitous that was starting at the time. And so our veterans who were in attendance there who didn't know about the long history of the research that had been going on in Boston were able to hear that. And I think they were able to hear that, you know, we're really trying to develop these biomarkers and treatments based on that early work. And they seemed to be receptive to hearing what we were doing and to be willing to dialogue with us on research studies and to get more clinical care. Because some were initially hesitant to even go to VA for clinical care because of just lack of knowledge, unfortunately, with some care providers over the years. So I think at least in the New England area, that's starting to change. We hope it happens across the country.
I want to hand it to y'all on the outreach, and I was there on the 7th Corps reunion in D.C. You and Dr. Steele were both there providing a table of information and being available to talk to Gulf War veterans. And I know that you had your Boston meeting, reunion, and review of research with the veterans, with the VA in attendance. And I know that they did this similar thing in Miami with Dr. Klimas. So I want to compliment you. These researchers are not only doing hard work, but they're out there outreaching to veterans, and they are making themselves available. There's a lot of reunions going on, and so, you know, the number you use to get in touch with Joanne, if you're out there and having a reunion group on our 25th reunion or any time, I highly recommend you touch base with Joanne, and she'll get with Dr. Sullivan and see if they can get somebody out to the reunion to talk to people and educate them. The vets need that. What is happening with professional sharing of information and, you know, presentations at, like, American Medical Association? Can you tell us a little bit of what our Gulf War researchers are doing in that area?
Sure. Actually, the laboratory scientists in our consortium are presenting heavily their research with the different types of exposures and what they're finding in the lab at the Society of Toxicology meetings that happen every year. Dr. O'Callaghan from CDC, Jim O'Callaghan, has been doing lots of presentations there, as well as some of our other researchers that we're working with. And on the clinical side of things, we've just been approved to and invited to present a symposium at the International Neuropsychological Society meeting that will happen in London this summer to talk about our consortium studies as well as some of the most recent treatment trials that results have come out on that Dr. Julia Golier from the Bronx VA will be talking about and Dr. Bill Meggs from East Carolina University will be talking about with his treatment of low-dose naltrexone. Among some other things. So we're trying to get the word out that the studies that the veterans participate in, we are most certainly putting out in papers as well as at scientific conferences so that other scientists can see what work is being done.
Meggs, God bless him. I mean, I was with him and Denise. We were together when Bill saw the light and finally realized what was going on, and it was like, here's this doctor that really cares. And when the light went on in his head and his eyes lit up, it was like, holy cow. Do you remember that day, Denise?
I sure do. I wanted to mention to certainly get the information to me on the UK, because we have UK veterans that can get the information to their doctors and maybe increase attendance at that meeting in the UK, because we had coalition countries.
Yes,
UK
absolutely.
And other countries are lacking the research. I've told them to get their researchers to apply to CDMRP and, you know, the way to connect with that, but we need to do more of that. And I know that the CDMRP is putting out information. I'm looking at one of their new books that I picked up from y'all of going through several of the researchers and what they're doing. I would, I had a thought there, and it kind of zipped through my mind, as you know, Scuff War Vets. But getting the word out, oh, I know what it was. What are we doing with getting the word out to VA and to VA doctors across the country? Is there any effort to have a VA conference and having all this research that's coming from other areas besides the VA to get disseminated to them?
That's a good question. And of course, when I was more involved with the Research Advisory Committee for VA, we were more of a position to recommend things of that sort. But I am no longer involved in that, so unfortunately, I can't really say too much to that, except that, as you mentioned, there has been a several 25th anniversary events that have happened, and of course the one that we had in our area was at the Boston VA, so there were some VA clinicians and other folks who were there to hear what we were doing in terms of disseminating information. And at the Miami VA, Dr. Klimas, of course, has been working on Gulf War illness for many years, and has also had many clinicians there as well. And she actually invited me to present at that meeting as well. And so there were several clinicians who were trying to learn more about Gulf War illness there. So at least in some parts of the country, there is a big push to try and educate more VA clinicians who are dealing directly with care for veterans. You know, one of the things that we did with the Research Advisory Committee was we put out those books every several years, and that's something that I would always tell veterans, you know, if your primary care physician, if you don't feel like they're educated, give them one of these RAC books. I mean, that is the summary of all the research that's been done to date, on, you know, in so many years, increments. The first report, of course, was the first 10 years or so, and then after that it was, you know, the next 5 or 7 years worth that we covered. So that's something that we would always say, you know, give that to your primary care clinician, and we would be happy to send those reports out to our veterans and give you multiple copies to give to your caregivers as well. And in addition, we recently, the Research Advisory Committee investigators separately put out a smaller article. Sometimes our reports are very large, and so there was a smaller article that was published recently in Cortex, the journal, that is a free access article that veterans can give to their primary care physicians as well, that very briefly summarizes the research to date and recommendations that the committee had made for care of Gulf War veterans.
Beatrice Golob, God bless her, has found so much with the mitochondria out there in San Diego. What's new on that, or where's that going?
Yes, she's actually actively funded to do lots of different studies, and she actually was the one who did the first coenzyme Q10 study, which was designed to try and improve mitochondrial functioning. And I did mention that, you know, a larger study is going to happen now, but that's exactly right. She was at the forefront of using that therapy, and I believe is doing some other therapies aimed at improving mitochondrial function in Gulf War veterans.
Yeah, we'll be having, I'm trying to line her up, Doug, because their funding is just getting rolling, and so they will have new research that'll be open to the vets. So we'll be getting her online also, hopefully, for an interview. We have so many researchers now involved besides the consortium. We have Georgetown, and we pre-recruited for them, so they have plenty of their sick Gulf War vets lined up to get in. We have Minneapolis that has studies going. We have some studies in Salt Lake City on probiotics, and I think one's been funded on dietary items.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get everything across the country, but it's been a struggle with funding. I mean, this was all funded through efforts like Anthony and I have gone up and headed up pushing for funding every year for the Congressionally Directed Medical Research. And we started with $5 million, and we're up to $20 million. But every year we have to go to bat and get support for that on the Hill that goes through defense appropriations. And I've mentioned that on the program several years when we've been working that effort, that veterans can have a direct input in helping us to get that support. But, you know, we've really progressed. Like I said, it started 05-06, and it takes a little while to get the research programs up and running through contracting and getting everything running. But, you know, we've... you know, I try to find other researchers to get involved. You know, the reason I mentioned Boulder is I'm in Colorado. I've traveled a lot to be a part of the research, not only supporting the funding and pushing for it, but, you know, putting my own body out there. And, yeah, I had a pen a long time ago on guinea pig. Well, it's one of the things that if you have a cancer, if you have anything, patients eventually get involved and advocate. Civilian chronic fatigue groups have done that, and it does make a difference. It helps the researchers to help us. So it's not really a guinea pig. They're really tuned in to showing the proof that we were damaged and finding that proof and then going step further with animal research into trying different treatments so that we can try it with our GUF-4 vets. So I think we've made a lot of progress. Dr. Sullivan, how do you feel about that?
Yes, I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress, and you're absolutely right, Denise. It's because of the veteran advocates who've been able to get the funding through the CDMRP. And, of course, as you know, that funding is not restricted to just particular government agency investigators. So, for example, VA will only fund VA investigators. So if you're a researcher at a university, you can't get VA funding. And so there, for a long time, there was difficulty getting funding to do the studies that, you know, some researchers may want to do if they weren't within certain government agencies. So I agree the CDMRP program has made a very big impact in bringing researchers from all different walks of academics and industry. So there are small companies looking at different types of biomarkers for Gulf War illness. There are university professors. There are government agency investigators as well. And I think in our consortium, we actually have all of those working together. And I think that has made a very big difference in pushing the field forward so quickly since the CDMRP program has come into place. And it's only been 2007, I believe, was the first awards.
We got the funding in 05 for 06, so it probably was 07 that we actually got the studies going.
That's right, yep. And actually, I think I was one of the first ones who actually got funded under that program, which was a very exciting thing. But and to see that the treatment development in that amount of time was tremendous. So having seen pretty much two treatments in the 90s, no treatments until the mid-2000s, and then to see it expand like this has really been a really important thing for the researchers to try and see what may be helpful to our veterans, and of course for the veterans to see that we have most certainly not given up on trying to develop treatments that will help.
The implications are just staggering all the way around. I mean, we have to look at military operations and all the exposures and what we wrought when we do it. And I mean, one of the things we're concerned with, the destruction of the infrastructure, and it releases all the chemical, biological, inorganic, organic compounds, heavy metals, radiological, all of the pesticides. I mean, the battlefield today is a complex, toxic nightmare, and it can't be continued allowed to go on like that without prompting out medical care for, I mean, we're looking at 2 million vets now. It's staggering numbers. They keep increasing every day.
That's right, and that's what I was sort of hinting to previously, that, you know, the work that collectively the researchers are doing on the exposures and the chronic outcomes from these effects in our Gulf War veterans is not only important for our Gulf War veterans, but highly translatable to other groups as well. So I think you hit it right on by saying that.
Well, God bless you, Dr. Sullivan. Thank you very much for all you're doing.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come and talk about our work. And, you know, I thank all the veterans who've been willing to participate in our studies over the years, and I hope that some will participate in our consortium studies as well. So thank you.
Dr. Sullivan and Joanne, I think, is still around.
Yep.
What have you learned from the vets that have come to you so far, besides, you know, their blood research and genetics and everything? What have you personally gained from interacting with the veterans? I know you've been doing it for a long time, Dr. Sullivan, and Joanne is your study coordinator and spends a lot of time in doing the study, the neurocognitive testing and all. What insights have you had from the vets themselves?
Well, first of all, that they're so grateful that this is being looked into, and really they just want answers. So they're willing, you know, to travel on their own dime a lot of the times to come here and do this because they just want to find out what is happening with them, and they want treatments. It's been so long, and that I think, you know, they just really deserve it. So, yeah.
Well, I thank each of you, and you know I'm there for you, helping to recruit and doing everything I can to promote your study and other researchers' studies and trying to help find a way to get the vets to you. And encouraging the vets is the other thing that we might need to have a program on, Doug, is how to be an effective advocate. I'm getting older, guys. and there is a need, not only during the time that we have to push the hill in D.C. to sign on and help us get the funding, but what else they can do in educating their doctors at the VA. The ideas they may have. So we have a lot of other programs to cover, and I sincerely thank both of you for being on the air today with us.
Thank you, and
thank
God
you
bless
both for
you,
the invitation.
God bless America.
Thank you, guys.
Take care of our vets.
Thank you. Okay.